Now entering Nerdist.com.
It's the Nerdist Writers Panel on the Nerdist Podcast Channel. Ben Blacker talking writing with writers. Writers talking writing
can get pretty exciting.
The talk can be enlightening.
It's very rarely frightening.
Ben Blacker talking writing with writers.
Welcome to the Nerdist Writers Panel Series, an informal chat about writing, television, and the business of writing television. Each and every panel benefits 826LA, the national nonprofit tutoring program. For more information on 826LA, visit 826LA.org. I'm your moderator, Ben Blacker. Follow me on Twitter, at Ben Blacker. I'm the co-creator of the Thrilling Adventure Hour, a stage program in the style of old-time radio, available as a podcast on iTunes. For more information, go to thrillingadventurehour.com. I'm also currently a writer on the CW Supernatural. We have three terrific guests tonight. The first one, she has written on Chelsea lately. She has written on the sitcom Perfect Couples. And she's a terrific stand-up comic and writer. And follow her on Twitter, at Jen Kirkman, everybody.
Right here.
Oh, you come this way.
Thanks, Ben.
They've never walked that close to me before. You guys have been here before. It's uncomfortable.
Pot F. Tomcat's regular.
Right, a Pot F. Tomcat.
Thank you, sir. This is fuck you, Ben. But that's not writing.
Listen.
That's why he didn't mention it. Fuck you, sir.
Our next panelist has been a writer for the all of Conan's shows. That's right, right? Pretty much all of them. Since Conan was in middle school. Brian Stack, everybody. Thank you, Brian.
Oh, thank you.
And finally, our third panelist has written his own material. He's written for other people. He's an actor. He's a director. He'll talk about all the myriad projects that he's been involved with. Bob Odenkirk, everyone. Hey, Jen. Thank you, Bob.
Am I being podcasted yet?
Not yet.
I won't.
We'll tell you when.
I don't speak unless I'm on the internet.
Do not blame you. Yeah, please adjust your mics. Get comfortable. You talk into it like it's an ice cream cone.
Okay.
So these are three great writer performers who will be telling you all kinds of interesting and hilarious things, I'm certain. Your moderator tonight is also a dear friend. And a great guy, and really a terrific writer. He's written a ton of animated properties, including Teen Titans, Johnny Test, Batman Brave and the Bold. He was involved with the Pink Panther reboot a year or two ago, X-Men Evolution. He's the executive producer of Chuck, The Adventures of Chuck and Friends, which is on The Hub. He's also written a ton of comics, such as Teen Titans, Robin. This one he's involved with, Countdown to Adventure. Oh, you're right. And he's rebooted or relaunched Batman Beyond to huge success. And it's a terrific book, and you should pick it up if you're of that mind. Adam Beechin, everyone. Thank you.
Thanks, Ben. Ice cream cone, ice cream cone, ice cream cone. Well, hi, everybody.
Hi.
Thanks for being here. Really appreciate it. Want to just jump right in because the less of me, the better, and the more of you guys, the better. All of you have written for yourself and for other people, written as individuals or worked with partners or on a staff. In your heart of hearts, which do you prefer? Do you prefer writing on your own or do you prefer writing with other people? And can you tell us a little bit about why?
Go.
Oh,
you're the lady, Jen.
I
don't know if you know, but you're a lady.
First. Thank you. I like writing with other people better. I can't tell if anything's funny when I'm by myself, unless I go bring it on stage. So if I'm not writing stand up, then I like writing with other people better. But I don't have a writing partner, and I never want one because I don't work well with others in certain ways. But I like to be on a staff where everyone's just, you know, yelling things out and throwing out ideas. So I feel very comfortable with that. So I guess it's when I'm writing for me, I want to be the only one doing it. But in general, I have more fun with other people.
So just one-to-one? You don't like bouncing just off of one person?
No, because I don't like to give in, but I will, you know? And then I don't like to disagree. It makes me so uncomfortable. It brings up so many issues for me. So I can't. I don't know how writing partners do it. It seems it's great, but I can't do that.
I feel the same way. Brian?
Yeah, never having done stand-up.
You are, dude.
Ice cream
mic
cone,
technique
Brian.
Is ice cream pathetic. They don't teach you mic technique in the Conan writing
room. No, they don't.
At all.
It's a huge blind spot.
Jay Leno came and took all the mics away.
Yeah, he did. Like a boy from the third world.
Man. What is this?
Speak. Never
what is
seen
this mystical
mic.
Thing?
You know, your voice is being recorded.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow, thanks for filling me in on all this, Bob. No, never having done stand-up or never having done solo performing, really all the writing I've ever done has been collaborative. So, and I really enjoy that. I don't think I would... occasionally I've written a couple sketches just totally on my own, but most of the time it's been bouncing ideas off other people. So that's really been the only... Even back in Chicago where... Like, Bob worked at Second City, too, and, like, it's very collaborative, and you're bouncing ideas around with other people. So that's pretty much all I've ever done.
I don't see how you write comedy. People try to write it alone, and it's just rarely great. I mean, all the great stuff is coming out. It comes out of a room or a couple people because you prove your stuff to other people, and you get those perspectives from other people. And it boosts your idea, it takes it to another place, someone else. It's easier to critique someone else's idea than to come up with your own, but that doesn't mean it's not valuable. It's really valuable to have a person see another angle into an idea or see some jokes you didn't see or see a direction it can go you didn't see. I love writing with other people, and I've written a lot with other people, and I've written a lot alone. And there's values to both. I mean, David Cross and I, that's like the best. That's a rarity. We still, when we write together, it's just as much fun as the first time. It's just as much surprise as the first time. I mean, we're kind of the same mind comedically in a really strange way. So it's just as easy for us to write, like right now, we could go write something. And we'd have a great time and make each other laugh and surprise each other. And so that's just rare, though. That doesn't happen. I've written with lots of people, and I've had lots of people where you just kind of get tired of them. You know where they're going to go. But it's still great to write with somebody. And I don't – sometimes I meet young comedy writers, and they talk to me or show me their writing. And what I want to say and what I do tell a lot of people is – try to work with somebody better than you. That's my number one pitch. But if you can't find anybody better than you, who you sit there and go, how'd they do that? Then just work with people who are good, who make you laugh, and who you enjoy working with. You really should be working with people because any TV show, and, you know, look, I'm a big Woody Allen fan, and there's one or two movies he's written alone that are really great, but most of his great movies were co-written.
Agreed.
And he's, you know, you can't get better than him. And if he's got to co-write the great stuff, then you probably do too.
Marshall Brinkley.
I do, yeah. Jen, going back to the stand-up stuff then, the writing solo process, is that particularly painful and difficult if you're not getting that immediate audience response? And how much work do you do on your own before you start testing the stuff in front of audiences?
I always think I'm going to be this kind of stand-up that sits and writes, and I'll write pages and pages and pages, and maybe one thing of it is funny, and it's not even the thing I wrote. It's like a kernel of a thing, and I say it differently on stage, and then it works. So for me, some people write jokes, and they're funny, and they work on stage. I don't know. I can't do that. I have to write a million things, almost like a diary, and then say what interested me the most, and then I still have to take it on stage and work it out there. And then the pressure of being on stage, sometimes it's, jokes will form magically, and then I'll remember them and write them down later. But yeah, pages and pages of shit, and then maybe one thing that's funny from it.
Let me ask you, because I've just started following you on Twitter, and it's a fantastic feed, by the way.
Thanks.
Do you find yourself tweeting stuff out and getting response and finding ways now to sort of incorporate that into your stand-up material? Are you finding kernels out there that you've tweeted out to the world and come back to?
I've tried that because I will tweet political jokes or pop culture jokes, but that I don't do that in my act. And I'm like, oh, well, this will be easy because I made a tweet about it and people liked it, so I'll bring it on stage. And I've tried. I can't find a way to say it because my Twitter voice is my organic voice, but it's not the way I talk.
Right.
So it's been really hard for me to realize that the way I write on there is just not the way I talk, and the way I talk has to be the way I do stand-up. And it's like, it seems like, why don't she just fucking calm down already? This is too analytical, but it's really true. I can't make it work. So
that was more than 140 characters.
Yeah,
right,
yeah.
Bob and Brian, I noticed that both of you guys did a lot of work in college on radio. I was wondering how that kind of work prepared you or helped prepare you for the kind of stuff that you do now.
I leave it to Brian's answer for me. Brian, you give my answer and I'll give yours.
Okay. Well, Bob's experience in radio was very, very traumatic.
Listen to that voice, huh?
That's a radio voice.
Yeah, we're back with Crazy Joe in the morning. Let's call Chinese people and make fun of their names.
There was actually a Chicago DJ, Mancow, who did that. Man, he was the worst.
What did he do?
He called Chinese people and made fun of their names.
Wait, is that the same Mancow?
Yes, it is.
Oh, I was like, there's two Mancows?
Okay. Yeah. He's probably the only one. But actually, my college radio experience is very minimal. And the Indiana University station, I think, had about 7 listeners. And it was like a cable radio station, so there was this one restaurant where the chefs would call and request songs. And that was about the only people I ever heard from. But it was educational because it turned me on to some bands that I would have never heard of, like Social Distortion and the Butthole Surfers. other bands I was too sheltered to know about otherwise. But it was fun. It was fun. It was
because you had the sense that you had so few listeners, do you feel like that was a license to sort of improvise and try out things and go nuts a little bit?
You know, it is. I think one thing about the Chicago scene, too, and I think Bob might relate to this somewhat, is that because there's not really an industry presence, I do think that there is some sense of not, because you're not being scrutinized or because there's no casting directors in the audience, I do think there's an opportunity to develop a little more and kind of find your own voice a little bit, as corny as that sounds.
No, I think that's really true. I think, you know, and that's what radio, I mean, look, I did radio in college because it's a stage and you can get on it, and I did sketch shows that were a lot like Mr. Show, really, that's what they were. And David Cross did a show in Boston called Cross Comedy that was Mr. Show. I mean, so it's just a stage to work on. I think radio can be amazing. I love Paul F. Tompkins' podcast. It's great. My kids love it. They're very entertained, and I love how radio is. I mean, I used to love Bob and Ray, and I used to listen to Bob and Ray a lot. Credibility Gap is a great radio comedy group that included Chris Guest and Harry Shearer and Michael McKeon, and they did amazing stuff, and I don't know if their stuff's available still, but boy, it's great. I had their albums and listened to them, so I even like Firesign Theater, which is kind of a different kind of a absurdist kind of intellectual thing, less funny than it is kind of mind-blowing, but really great. And and I think the guys who made it would agree with that. They weren't trying to be silly, funny so much. But radio is great. It's a great just stage, and you can use your imagination and make almost anything happen for very little money, and it's great.
While I've got you talking about Bob and Ray and Firesign and people like that, do you guys want to talk a little bit about your influences, all three of you? Not joined influences, obviously.
Don't have to share influences.
Someone else go first, because I have to think.
Well, Bob mentioned one of my all-time favorites is Woody Allen, and I think Monty Python, Woody Allen, Peter Sellers, SCTV, early SNL, that stuff probably warped my mind more than anything. I think it was definitely the biggest.
That list is about the same as me, but I would say mine's probably Monty Python number one, then just a bunch of things. Woody Allen, Credibility Gap, Bob and Ray. I mean, early SNL was fun, and SCTV was really fun to see. I think Second City Theater, seeing that when I was 12 and then again when I was 14 was had a huge impact on me. But because, you know, where I grew up in Naperville and the family I grew up in, my mom was very Catholic, religious, and not entertainment was very low on the order of things of value in the world. And she's a very funny lady, too. But, you know, the idea of doing this for a living or doing it seriously, thinking about it and working on it, is just so far away from anything anyone would consider or talk about or, you know. So going to Second City was a huge influence on me because I went to a place where people that I could see were doing this thing that I loved for a living. You know, it wasn't this thing on TV where you go, I don't know how you become one of those things. You have to be born in Los Angeles, I think, and yeah, I don't know. You know, that's just another planet, you know. And so that made it kind of real to me, which I think was very impactful. And then just, I mean, I think I'm still influenced by things. I mean, you know, Ricky Gervais's stuff, especially The Office, I think influenced everybody in comedy. It should have, if it didn't. You know? So I think I'm still influenced by stuff. But the early stuff was definitely... and Steve Martin, too. Martin's first albums. Yeah. I mean, that was... Steve Martin, Woody Allen, Credibility Gap, and Monty Python, and Bob and Ray. That was mine.
Sure.
Yeah.
And at the risk of embarrassing Bob, I think like Mr. Show has become, I think, one of the big touchstones for the next generation. I don't think there's anyone I've met in comedy that's younger than me that wasn't influenced.
What about Breaking Bad?
Oh, I think that's... Next I honestly think that's the best show on TV right now.
Influencing people to do meth.
Yeah. I hear pure you want to make it a legal meth. Drama.
Yeah. Only the purest chemical meth. You want high standards, you know.
Jen, how about you?
Yeah, early SNL. My parents let me stay up and watch it. Johnny Carson, Letterman. Sitcoms were big for me when I was a kid. Taxi. I mean, these were all probably I was catching the reruns, but Taxi was really important to me. Even Welcome Back, Kotter. I knew it was corny then, but I love a good corny joke. And Roseanne and Bill Cosby stand up, and like Bob said later, Ricky Gervais and. Even like writing like David Sedaris or David Rakoff, any of those that kind of essay stuff has been really influential even in how I approach stand-up. And there's some like Larry David and any kind of cranky old guy I'm into.
All you cranky old guys out there?
Yeah, so he's not old. But that's all been it. Richard Lewis, that's all a huge influence. I mean, Woody Allen, too.
Any non-comedy influences on your writing?
Oh.
For all you guys?
Morrissey. Well,
really?
Mm-hmm. He's super funny.
Yeah, he's very funny.
And his lyrics, yeah, are really dark and funny. And that's an influence on my writing, but I think it just influenced my sense of humor, definitely, growing up. I don't know if it would be... And I always cite this as the reason I got into comedy. Like, as much as I watch Carol Burnett and all that stuff, there's this song by the Beach Boys, Barbara Ann.
Sure.
And in the middle of it, like, it sounds like a... They're just all shit-faced, and it's just a mess of a song if you really listen to it. It's like, they're like, try this, da, 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 and they're all laughing in the middle. I remember as a kid obsessively calling a radio station in Oldies 103 in Boston and requesting it, and I feel like, I don't think I was this, not that this is a smart thing to say, but I don't think I was as self-aware as a kid. But deep down, I know, I want to hear these adults act like kids. They're fucking around. They're having fun. They're not acting anything like my teachers, my parents, or my parents' friends. So whatever that is that these weirdos are doing, that vibe is what I want to always be around. So I feel like that little thing is so much bigger to me than I saw Eddie Murphy do Gumby. Like, because that was just entertainment, but that like connected with my heart somehow.
Yeah, like I think my all-time favorite band is The Replacements, and they have such a great sense of humor in their music.
Yeah.
But I think also, if I'm really honest with myself, that their tendency to kind of shoot themselves in the foot was also something I and a lot of my friends related to. A lot of my friends aren't very good at self-promotion and tend to kind of sabotage themselves. And I think they did that a lot, and I think I always related to that. But I think their sense of humor and their genuine spirit, and I think they were one of the funniest and saddest bands. You know, the combination of the two is always amazing to me. You know, and I know Bob loved them too.
Yeah, I love the Replacements, and Morrissey is really funny. Yeah, that kind of stuff. I think Charles Portis is a writer who I just watched True Grit again, the Coen Brothers version last night. My kids have watched it. It's the darkest film they've ever seen, but it's so funny. I mean, it's so funny to me. Every single scene makes me laugh, and I look at my son. Last night, I just kept looking over at him going, because of the way people talk, and everybody is very flowery and full of themselves, but everyone's really sarcastic. Everyone's just putting each other down and being rude, but in a very nice way. And Charles Portis is a great and very funny writer, and that's a great representation of his sensibility. His other book that they're trying to make into a movie, Bill Hader wants to make it into a movie. I don't know if it'll become much of one, because his other books are kind of a little, they just meander too much. True Grit had more direction to it. But Masters of Atlantis is one of the funniest books ever, and so I guess Portis, and otherwise I mostly I love comedy, and I love certain kinds of comedy. And what you mentioned, Jen, I think about Bill Murray on SNL when you say that, since that thing you see that makes you just so happy and feel like, wow, mm-hmm. if I could just have a little of that in my life, wow. I mean,
yeah.
And it's weird because I've done a lot of comedy that's too much in the head, and you know it's too conceptualized, and the fact is, you know, comedy when it's great should have that thing that Bill Murray sort of always has, which is like fucking around. I mean, it's just a guy mm-hmm. fucking around.
Oh, Caddyshack. How could I not have named that as
well, yeah.
a big influence? Well, I guess that...
You can skip Caddyshack.
Writing?
Trust me. It's okay.
Oh,
watch
my,
it again.
Oh,
I'm
no.
There's
my
no, I know. I've had so many...
Kid.
There.
Well,
can we talk about things that didn't influence us?
Yeah. Sure.
Okay,
yeah,
let's
absolutely.
Talk about things that didn't influence
sure.
us.
Sure. Let's start in the 16th century.
I am not a fan of Mel Brooks at all. Not at all. And I don't care. Blazing Saddles, that's the funniest film ever. And I've watched it and gone, oh, are you kidding me? This is embarrassingly awful. And Caddyshack, you know, Sandler's favorite film, and a lot of people who I love and who are funny, and I think it's okay. It's all right. It's not great. I there's things that don't influence me. Let's talk about
okay.
those. Let's hear from you guys some things that you have to hear.
What stuff do you just
hate? You have to hear about Mel Brooks,
well,
how great he is all the time?
Yeah, I hear a lot about that.
Can I see... I probably can't get through 5 minutes of Blazing Saddles without...
I kind of actually feel that way about, as a stand-up, Steve Martin stuff. I never connected with it. I'm not saying it's not funny. I'm saying I did not connect with it. But I'm a woman, and I don't know if it was like too guy humory. Like Kenny Jackson, it's fucking no point in that. But I just never connected with me. When I was a kid, I wanted to hear adults telling stories. I did not like wacky stuff. I don't like anything wacky, really. Anything like Princess Bride, I did not enjoy. I'm sorry. It doesn't influence me. It's not, my mind doesn't work that way. So I get that it's good, but please stop telling me to watch these things. And I know Steve Martin's early stuff, and I like him. But I'd rather the serious Steve Martin who's writing about art than the arrow in the head. I know it's funny, but it's not for me.
Yeah, I was amazed when I he's one of the few times when he was a guest on Late Night. I usually left the guests alone, but he was one of the few guys I felt like, I just got to give a quick thank you to. And he was like an art professor. Very, very nice, but yeah. very gracious. And completely unwacky. You
know? Yeah.
I guess I don't want to hear any more about Andy Kaufman. I liked him on Taxi as Latka. I know he didn't like that, but...
Oh, I agree with you on Andy Kaufman.
I don't care about the behind.
I totally agree with you on Andy Kaufman. And by the way, I like Andy Kaufman and some of the things he did and some of the things I've heard that he did, you know, bits that you've only heard about. The thing where he reads The Great Gatsby and gets really insulted when people are getting... and then he starts to read it. And that's really
that
funny.
That sounds really funny.
But there's something about him, too, where you know, so often in reviews of comedians, of artists, there's this conscious... thought or thinking that is ascribed to the artist on the work they're doing and the impact of it and the meanings of it, and so much of what we do, I think just a lot of artists, they're just doing what there's something broken inside them and they're just moving in that direction, you know, because they're missing this thing or whatever. And they're not thinking about the impact or aware of it or caring. I mean, that's the weird part for me, is the part where they don't seem to care. I don't think Andy Kaufman gave a shit that no one liked him or in this audience or that audience. He may have been proud of it at times. I'm going to walk the room, you know. If you read Lenny Bruce's autobiography, it's a great book. Who's a guy who is kind of funny to me? Not that funny, but
I think he's funny to me. That's a great book. Everyone should read it.
But he talks
like
about. I think it's in the epilogue or something he added in. But there. Oh, it was in an interview that was added into a version that I had. He talks about not. You know, look, I wanted to please the audience. If they weren't laughing, I'm trying to get laughs. And I think there's a certain people like Andy Kaufman who, I don't think he was trying to get laughs at all. He just had a performance bit in his mind. Oh, what if you did this? What if I did that? You know? Mm-hmm. And he had this thing where he was celebrating TV when he was a kid. He used to watch the TV and he wanted to do a fake talk show just like this. What? You're just, something's wrong, man. You know, look, if you want to laugh at him and call him a comic genius, he'll take it. But he's just doing what he does, you know? So for me, I've never liked absurd just for absurd's sake. And I think I kind of draw a little bit of a line between people who are just broken in a very clear way, and they're acting that out on stage, and everyone's laughing, but really, no, there's something wrong with them. And they know that you like to hear them do this. They know that it makes an audience come and they get paid for it, you know, but they aren't really in control of what they're doing or how it impacts people, you know. I mean, Gilbert Gottfried's really funny to me, but he's going to make jokes about the plane that went down yesterday or the tsunami that killed. He's just, that's
different,
you know,
kind of filter.
There's no filter.
Right.
There's no filter at all. And he doesn't even understand a filter. What about a filter, Gilbert?
Right, he's not thinking, I got no filter. That's
what
my
are you
hook.
Talking
that's
about?
That's his thing, yeah.
And it's not even an awareness. It's just, yeah. So I feel like with Andy Kaufman, there's a kind of a thing where it's really cool that he did all this weird stuff. It's really cool that the audience was willing to sit through it and kind of see it as humor and enjoy it, because I remember going to do stand-up at the Improv in New York when I was first at SNL, and seeing the pictures on the wall, all these photos, and there's Andy and all these different acts, and, you know, that was a great time. Now if you go to the Improv, I mean, it's changed again because of alternative comedy. It's changed it a bit, I would say. But when the stand-up boom happened, people like Andy Kaufman would never have survived that stand-up boom. A young Andy Kaufman would never have had a career at all. No, just get away from here. You can't get on stage and read The Great Gatsby. You tell jokes like they do on Carson, and that's it. And you get out of here if you're not going to do that. And so I think that was neat that there was this time when people were doing really awkward, offbeat stuff and allowed to do it, and the audience was expected to enjoy all these different variety of performance.
My own sense of Andy, and I haven't seen a lot of his work, obviously, was that he was all about trying to get the most extreme reaction he could get from the audience, whether it was laughter or booing or whatever. And I kind of wonder if he was just misclassified for a long time.
I think he kind of is. I think you're right. He's more of a performance artist. Yeah.
I remember seeing a documentary about when he was antagonizing these Southern wrestling crowds.
Yes.
And just seeing his willingness to be hated by an entire stadium full of people and saying things like, I'm a rich Jew from Hollywood. I'll sue you. And saying everything to make them hate him more, and saying everything. He goes, I've got lawyers. I've got lots of money. And just saying everything to make this entire crowd turn against him.
I mean, it's really funny, but I don't know. It's great if you want to do that. I mean, I'll laugh at it. You know,
I can't relate to it at all. Like, I could never ever even imagine doing something like that. So I was always fascinated. He seemed like another species to me, of extremely courageous comedian. You know?
See, but that's where I have a problem.
I think it's just crazy.
Courageous.
It could be. Maybe it was more crazy.
Something's wrong with you, and you don't see. I mean, what is it that he's missing there? I mean, if you're trying to be fair to everyone. Well, first of all, you will provoke people, and that does show us that they're dumb and they don't understand that you're putting on a show and you're just trying to provoke them, and they should see through that. But if you watch the tapes from that, you'll see a lot of people in the audience in the South, morons, laughing. So they do get it. They are getting it. Yeah, they think you're funny. They're yelling at you, but they don't really think you're insulting them. They think it's kind of funny, too. So now, who's this joke on? Who's this prank on? You know, and so, I don't know. I just, there's a certain thing where I like, see, the early Steve Martin, and you guys say he's kind of like a professor and all, and that's true. But he kind of knows what he's trying to do. He doesn't maybe always achieve it, but he's thinking about the impact of this and what he's trying to do, and he tries to achieve something, you know.
I want to come back to the notion that you brought up of alternative comedy and how that's happening today. I'm curious to know what your definition of alternative comedy, and if all three of you have a definition of alternative comedy.
Well, it's not a very tight definition, but there was a stand-up comedy boom, essentially. The way I understand it, and I may not have this exactly right, but stand-up comedy clubs like the Improv used to have a musical act, a stand-up act, and an alternative act, and that's how the night went. Those in an order, one then the other then the other. So, and the point was, you don't put a comic next to a comic because that's too much comedy, and people won't be able to take it, and they won't be able to sort of transition. And you know about this? You know,
I wasn't around, but I actually didn't even know about that, the music.
That's why I remember when I went to the Improv in New York, and there's all these musicians on this picture board, and I'm like, why are there people playing guitar on here? And they said, oh, the rule was in the 70s, musical act, stand-up, then alternative thing of whatever.
I guess it makes sense now, because Bud Friedman discovered Bette Midler, and I was used to be like, what was she doing? But she was probably the musical thing.
What's her face? Yeah. Pat Benatar, Catch a Rising Star.
Seriously?
Oh, my God. I didn't know that either.
Wow.
So that's how stand-up comedy was, right?
Right.
Then, there are fads. They come and they hit certain industries. And by the way, I think we're in the middle of a comedy fad, and I think it will end in a few years, so enjoy it. But don't think it's going to be around forever. Kind of an alternative comedy fad where there's a lot of improv groups and shows and stuff like that. But this fad hit. It was a stand-up fad. And in a town like Chicago where I was, and there was one Zanies, maybe two, and I think there might have been one Funny Bone. So maybe there were three clubs, right? Like 3 years later, there were 9, 12 clubs, full-time clubs. The Funny Bone opened 4 clubs. Zany's opened 4 other clubs. I mean, it was a crazy thing that just changed in like 2 years. It went from, there's one Zany's in town to...
Pow.
There's 4 Zanies, 4 Funny Bones, and 3 other little independent clubs. And comedy night at every bar. At every bar. At Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday. You could work every night of the week, make $15 as an opener or whatever at any bar in town. And that just was a weird thing. It just was a fad that came. And with that came... no more musical acts, no more alternative acts, just stand-up, just Jerry Seinfeld clones. Just please, just give us somebody who wears a suit and tells jokes about airplane food. Just go all night long. And it was like, you know, the weird thing was I saw some amazing performers and one who I've sort of reconnected with named Tom Johnson, who I found out is running an improv theater in Portland. But one of the funniest stand-ups, I think, of all of us that were doing it. And people would laugh. During this one time, they'd come to these clubs, and they'd enjoy everyone, and they'd really enjoy Tom, right? But invariably, if you ask the audience, who's your favorite comic, they would always pick the most, one-liner, middle-of-the-road, nothing comic. And I just sort of realized that there was this thing that was being sold that everyone was excited about, and they wanted that thing. That's what they paid for. I remember there were nights where Tom did really well, and I'd ask people, who did you like? And they'd go, oh, he was funny, but I liked. And they'd name these guys who are still doing the clubs in Chicago. They're nowhere.
People who are just locked into the notion of what a traditional comedian
just
is.
Just doing that boring stuff. And because there was this... thing called stand-up comedy done by a guy in a suit with the sleeves pushed up. And that's what I'm here to see. And I don't care how funny that guy is. I loved him, but I paid for that. And so it was this weird thing, and it was great because there was money to be made, and if you could tell a few jokes, you could have some of it. And then it was kind of crappy because Andy Kaufman couldn't survive that. He would. Right. No one would get him out of here. That's not what I'm here for. So it kind of killed creativity, but this business exploded. It was a weird mix. And then, of course, all that collapsed because, that really grows thin after a few years. And then it was just like 5 years later, it was collapsing. So to me, alternative comedy was all the people who would have played in those comedy clubs, years before this explosion happened, but they couldn't live there, couldn't fit there, so they created this other scene, and that was, I got to be a part of that out in L.A., where I think it was maybe the spearhead of it. I don't really even know how much happened in New York. The Comedy Cellar was always kind of a good place in New York. But here... Uncabaret was amazing. I mean, that was amazing. And to me, that was like ground zero for that.
Didn't the Ben Stiller Show grow out of that scene?
It did. I mean, it grew out of that and a few other things that happened at the time. But if you're just talking about alternative comedy, and I think people doing it very well, and just a bunch of people trying to do this thing that, look, it was just... The weird thing is, it's just comedy. I mean, if you go see Andy Kindler... If you go see Patton Oswalt, I mean, I don't know, they're comedians. I mean, Patton's a lot like George Carlin, right? I mean, the way he does bits, and he's talking about the real world, and he's taking it far further, and he's got pieces and chunks, and it's just, really, it was comedy 10 years before.
Right.
But then it didn't fit in the clubs anymore, so it was an alternative to this mainstream movement that was huge. So the weird thing is to now call it alternative comedy is weird because it's alternative to what? That thing died. It doesn't exist anymore.
Right.
And it hasn't existed for a long time. And by the way, when I say Jerry Seinfeld, he's a genius. I mean, he's really funny, and I love watching him do stand-up. He's amazing.
He's just a particular kind of comic.
Yeah, he's really good at that.
Jen, do you feel alternative?
No, but when I started in the 90s in Boston and then New York. And when I started, you know, Boston was another one of those cities that had the boom. And I started in the collapse. Yeah. There was nothing. There was one club, and it was only for famous headliners to come through or the guy that had been doing it 30 years. There was no, like, young kids can get up and be an opener. There was literally nothing. And I, you know, I think Mr. Show was on the air, and Ben Stiller's show had been on. There was this kind of alternative. But I didn't know anything because I was in college and of money and of cable. I didn't know who Janine Garofalo was. This was like 97. I didn't know anything. I knew Joan Rivers and this woman Judy Gold and all the, like, stand-up, Robin Williams, Whoopi Goldberg. That's what I knew. Sam Kinison, George Carlin. Those are the people I liked. That's what I knew. I thought I would be a stand-up like these guys. And I never thought I was alternative or whatever. And I just went out into the world in Boston to do stand-up, and there was, like, nothing, nowhere to do it. And I met, Eugene Merman.
Yeah, yeah.
And he was running a show in the back of a bar, and I was like, oh, this isn't what I wanted. I wanted to do the clubs. And it's like, but there wasn't, you couldn't. So I started working at his show, and I didn't really know how to write jokes yet, so I would just get on stage and do monologues. And in my mind, I was doing what I saw Bill Cosby do. Not good like him, but I was doing a type of comedy that seemed pretty normal to me, just telling stories about my life. It wasn't quite on cabaret. It was I thought, a little more like stand-up-y. And then when I auditioned for the mainstream club, they finally were letting young kids like be openers. He was like, you're too alternative. And I was like, I don't know what that is. And so then I was like, well, I guess that's what I am, and I will not try to do anything else. But I didn't try to change how I did things. I just was like, all right, I guess I'm this. And then I went to New York, and I never, ever tried to get on the clubs there. I just stayed at Luna Lounge, and, you know, when Mark Maron and Janine Garofalo were running it, and just did those kind of rooms, and then rooms that my friends started in basements. And then now I do every kind of room, and I love it. I guess a lot of people would consider me alternative, but I just did... Probably.
I mean, it's not really alternative anymore. Cause,
no, but there's, you know, it's
got,
like,
a CD out and DVD,
yeah,
and
it's not underground, it's not, or in any.
Yeah,
way. But it's, I mean, like, I just did.
But I still. The only thing I would say is, and I don't really know this. Like, what's it like? Does the improv? I mean, you can play the improv, right?
I can, but I'm not up all the time there. But nobody is. I mean, it's hard to. But
right.
I play there, and I play Laugh Factory, and I just did Foxwoods Casino. And
I feel like what we call alternative comedy.
They
is
would
just,
not do
it's
that.
Comedy now. It's actually more. It's more powerful than the mainstream thing that we were reacting against. That doesn't almost exist, and nobody wants it that badly. So.
But I still hear these kind of hacky guys, and these are people my age too, but have this mentality of like, oh, the alternative comic. I'm like, I don't know what you're accusing me of. Like, there's guys, there's definitely these New York jagoffs, you know, like these guys, so it's still this word that exists, but it's not real. It's not
real.
Yeah,
it really is meaningless. It'll become more meaningless as this generation gets into their 30s, and they're no longer just like college kids or, you know, post-college kids hanging out at night, and they're actually just the adults of America.
Right.
And they're like, oh yeah, I know who Jen Kirkman is. I can watch that. I'm not afraid of that.
It's getting further away from the suit wearing one liner comedians.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, we're far away from that now.
Absolutely.
Far away. That's not really relevant. It's just that I would sort of feel like this kind of multi-headed comedy that's really great for the artists and for everybody, I think. Kind of, it still needs to, you know, when the economic power comes to that audience when they get older, then that will become even more like the mainstream and the main, you know, it'll become more important. But it's cool because what everyone's doing and what's working really well is kind of, it's just a real explosion of creativity. There's just a lot going on, a lot of different things. If you look at UCB, what a great snapshot of what's going on with any night you go there. You get stand-up, you get a sketch show. I mean, it's just crazy.
Yeah, and I want to talk about that kind of variety because all three of you are doing very different kinds of things in your own ways, and I want to ask a little bit about process, if I can. Brian, I'm not terribly familiar with how a show like Conan works necessarily. Are you a monologue guy? Are you a sketch guy? And can you walk us a little bit through your day as a writer for Conan?
Well, it's a bit of a shorter day than we used to have at late night. Late night, we used to be there probably like 13 hours a day and get home, get out at like 1 a.m. or something. But I've never worked on the monologues, except when he hosted the Emmys when we would all toss jokes in. But most of the stuff I've worked on has been sketch bits and character bits and things like that.
How far out are you working on bits before they're produced?
Sometimes it's day of, and sometimes, like when we used to do the fake cable channels years ago, we would have to shoot them over the course of like the week or two before. But a lot of times it's literally just throwing it together the same day.
And is that a bunch of you all working together in a room, or is that you guys split off into smaller groups and come up with bits? How does that work?
It really depends. It depends. Sometimes it's just you on your own, and sometimes it's you. If, like, for example, there were some character bits where I would usually write them with one other person or two other people, and you'd go off and then bring it to the head writer. Sometimes it would be a group of us in the room pooling ideas together, and I know Bob worked the first season himself, so, like, sometimes you were sending stuff from L.A., right?
Yeah, I was just on the first season of Conan, and I don't think I helped much.
Well, you had the boy that was depressing, right? Wasn't that your idea?
I did this, a couple things. The debate thing.
Oh, that the pro murder.
Yeah,
that was great. Yeah, Andy would be assigned. Like,
Andy would always
position.
Get assigned just the worst
the
side
position.
Of an argument.
Yeah. He had to be pro murder or something. that was amazing.
The positions you could not defend,
and he would end up winning. So.
Yeah. And then I just send in monologue jokes and anything. I just fax some stuff in, you know. I just spent the first 3 weeks there, and then I lived out here and did other stuff, but mailed stuff in.
Brian, you've got characters that have made it onto the show. The Interrupter, of course, being my favorite.
Oh, thanks.
Handy quality and a moderator. How do you balance writing for the characters that you play as opposed to servicing just what's in the needs of the greater show? I mean, do you have a desire to get your characters on there more?
You know, it really depends. Like, a lot of times, like, I always enjoyed creating characters for other people to play, too. But I got to say, it was always really fun to perform on the show. If something did come up where you got a chance to do a character, that was always I came out of an improv kind of performing background. So I think if it had just been writing, I think I might have been kind of frustrated, like, feeling like, oh, I'd love to get out there and do something, you know. So I think the best thing about, especially at late night, was the mix of writing and performing and the collaborative nature of, you know, oh, this character would be great for McCann, or this character would be great for so-and-so, or for one of our friends from UCB or something, you know. But I love doing the stuff myself, too. So
cool.
It's always a balance. Yeah.
Jen, you recently made a transition from doing one kind of writing to another kind of writing, going from Chelsea Lately to Perfect Couples, and I was wondering how difficult that transition was for you, writing for a whole cast of characters, putting together a multi-act story and all that kind of thing, where it wasn't really your background prior to that.
Right, yeah. It was interesting because Chelsea Lately is just straight-up joke writing. Yeah. And it's different because you say a joke, if it makes her laugh, it's on the show. Or even if she's not there, if it makes someone laugh, it's on the show, you know. And you might see your joke in some kind of form on the show that night, and it's really not, you're not laboring over it. It's a silly show, and you just, whatever, you know, here's the jokes. But in a sitcom, it's like, especially with a single camera, you don't have the live audience, so there's no way to test the jokes out. So it's really just a bunch of people's opinions. And
run
now
it by,
it's getting...
Run, you know what you do? You run it by a laugh track machine.
We didn't think of that. It's like you're sitting in a room. It's getting later and later. Everyone's getting more delirious. Maybe the joke you had at 3 was fine, but now you have 10 different ones, and now it's 11, and that's one in the script. So anyway, but the process is a lot more intensive, but, you know, there was different people to do different things, and everyone did a little bit of everything. For me, the most boring part was... figuring out, okay, we definitely want her to go to the store in this episode, but we want him to go to the store. It's too much going to the store, but they can't go together because they have a story. It's like doing math, and I'm like, oh, this sucks. So, and everybody hates it. All the writers hate it. But because that's the only thing they want to do for a living, they take the good, they take the bad.
Right.
There you have. But for me, I was like, well, no, I will not tolerate this. Like, I only want to write jokes, and then I only want to be performing. So I had an epiphany halfway through writing on a sitcom, like, oh, I'm in the wrong place for me. So that's why, I mean, I left because the job was done and the show's getting canceled, so I'm not going back anyway, but that's why I'm going back to Chelsea. But the process was very different, but the very same in a lot of ways. You're sitting in a big room. My favorite part was the punch up after the script was written, and some people would be asked to come stay late and then try to make the jokes better. And that's just fun, where you just say things out loud and you don't say like, what if we did this? You just say it as if you're the character and you just keep saying stuff until it hits. And again, that was just such a random process, because it's like you wait for like two other people to laugh and that's how you know it might be funny. But then you have to analyze, is it right for the network? Is it right for the character? It's a lot more shit.
Would you get to a point where you thought you had a perfectly good joke and it would continue on and continue on and you would just be grinding your teeth sitting in the room?
Saying, oh, like, why didn't we go with what I just said?
Yeah.
A couple times, but I knew why it wouldn't work. It was always like, this really isn't their voice, or, you know, I was such a newbie. They shouldn't have listened to me anyway, but just a couple times I was like, I really wish we could go here, but we can't. But no, I mean, not a lot. I mean, not too much.
I think there's something missing for me in that I don't understand that kind of overworking of a joke line that they do in sitcoms. And they don't always do it, but I've been on a few where I've seen it, and it's just like there's like five different lines for that moment. And it's like, is it really so hard? Like, two of them are great. Why don't you pick one? I mean, it's
not like one is
so much better than the others. There's just usually two or three that are good. And
yeah, with something like Chelsea, I mean, you're taping every day. The joke has to be there. It's fine. Let's go.
Yeah, it's more like let's go.
If you're taping every 8 days or every 7 days or whatever, you have a lot of time to come up with stuff that doesn't work as well as what you had before.
Yeah, exactly. And I used to do some punch-up writing for cartoons on Disney and stuff, and those sessions weren't very fun. It was a lot of like everyone being really funny and then being like, but we can't put any of that on the network. So it was just sort of like, let's get all the funny stuff out of our system and now think of like the sub level that's appropriate for Disney. And for kids, I mean, right, we can't make like, you know, 9/11 jokes on a kids cartoon, but you know, there's a lot of that, like you're having fun in the room and then it's like, okay, let's really write this.
I've been told, I've never worked on a three-camera sitcom, but I've been told that they get a chance to test out, like you said, they'll try all five jokes and see which one works. But with the single camera, yeah, you don't really have any audience feedback.
No, so just the table reads where it's like the network and the writer's laughing really hard so the network doesn't give any notes. And then, but you don't have a lot of time to try it out. And then sometimes the actors they want to throw in things. And man, you really do, like I thought I was an actor too. But then when you're a writer and you're dealing with actors, you're like, oh, these fucking people. Like, it's, you know, they were all great on the show. That's not what I mean at all. But just sometimes, like, when someone's like, what about this? You're like, oh, yeah, we said that at 11 last night. We've gone past that. You know, like, you just get this attitude. It's terrible.
And yet the show was canceled, so maybe your way was better.
Well, oh, God, no. I mean, this is being recorded. No, 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 no.
I'm only teasing.
No.
I promise, I'm only teasing. Bob, you've worked as a writer, a director, and a performer. How important as a writer do you think it is to have a background in all of those disciplines? Does it make you a better-rounded comedian, a better-rounded writer?
I think it's good to be... I think it's good to do all those things, you know? I think it always helps each thing you're doing, you know? I mean, as an actor, I'm way more sensitive to the writers than maybe a person who just came out of acting school or something, because I know usually, and I kind of give them credit for having sweated this stuff, and so I'm a little, you know, I'm very careful about saying, what if I said this? And I'm certainly always willing as an actor to just go, look, I'm just going to suggest something, but you know, if you tell me you want it like this, that's it. It's done like this. I never insist.
But do you feel like having a background as an actor, when you're writing, you have a better sense of how something is going to play?
I don't know. I feel like I've always written for the idea, for the concept, and for the characters, depending on how important they are in the concept, but it's usually pretty equally split, right? And And so I've always written that way. And you asked Brian earlier about writing for himself and stuff. And I think we're probably similar in that we always write the bit first, and then maybe there's a part we'd like to do, but it's not really the most important thing when you're writing it to write something for yourself. You're trying to write a comedy bit that's done really well as it can be executed. And then, you know, you want to give it to certain people. Maybe even you imagine that when you're writing it because it can inspire you. But always write the bit first and let the idea be the most important thing and the scenario. And then, so what was your question? Let me just say, I think the directors should act and write, even if they hate it. They should force themselves to do it. Because I think that one of the things I see directors do is kind of not understand how to talk to actors and get something out of them without being a dick and reading the line reading the way you want it, you know, and not knowing how to talk about something that you're trying to get across to them. And I just think you get a lot out of it. There's more you'd get out of it as a director. I think writers don't need to direct, you know, if they don't want to. I mean, I feel like the writer's the most important person in the process. Bottom line, that's it. There's no argument, I think, for me. There's nobody can argue with me that then win that.
Come on,
to
somebody
me.
Try.
I understand that in the end, the director is going to, you know, define the sensibility or the tone and stuff. And I understand that the actor's interpretation is massively important, but come on, there's just zero without writing, and if there's good writing, it could be a pretty good thing, even if you botch it. And if the writing's not very good, it doesn't matter how much skill the other people bring to the table, you got a Guy Ritchie film.
That's what amazed
I'm
me
so
about.
I'm so sorry.
But God, when you
kidding, it's a joke. It's a joke.
When you see someone,
but did you notice that everyone laughed?
Everyone did. I was here to see it.
When you see someone like Billy Wilder, who was a writer and director, who could make his own words come to life as a director, it's just mind-boggling to see across genres too. Like his ability to cross different genres, it's always amazing. But I'm always amazed when there's a director who doesn't, like a director like Sidney Pollack. I completely understand why actors wanted to work with him, because he'd been an actor and he, right, you know, could talk to them on that level. And I think
it expands the vocabulary at the very least.
Yeah. Exactly.
So that's good.
Yeah.
That's enough from me. I want to hear what questions you all have. So let's open this up to the floor for questions. I'll try and repeat your question as best as I can into the mic so that it's covered for the podcast, but right down in front first.
Okay. Each of you have dealt with networks either screwing with you or canceling what you were on doing. How do you cope with that? How is people who haven't gotten anything on the air yet, like we're just trying to pitch our stuff and learn this, how do you cope with, because to me that's my biggest fear, I guess, and nervousness about dealing with people who don't get it and having this thing you love and that you put on paper get botched.
So coping with outside voices that may be coming at it from a more
well,
of a business
here's the
perspective.
Thing. You know, if you're going to do this, right, it's not, you know, it costs money to do what we want to do. It costs money to make a film, even a pretty cheap film, and it certainly costs money to promote it, edit it, get it out there. So you're going to have to deal with industry if you want to do comedy outside of stand-up. Stand-up, you can just get up there with a mic, and you can win the audience over, and nobody can argue with you, and it doesn't cost much to do. But any of this other stuff, sitcoms, films, you are going to have to interact with the industry. So you got to start to get to know those people and think about what they're thinking about. And you can't just say, I don't like them or I'm worried about them and I don't know if they'll like my stuff. I mean, they are part of your life if you are serious about this. And so you've got to interact with that aspect of this business. I mean, I don't know what that would mean to you, but you know, there's programs offered by networks and stuff to, you know, you just have to interact with the business. I mean, you know, the needs of the industry are not my needs. I mean, I just want to do the funniest thing I can tomorrow. I want to write the thing that makes me happy and put it in a context that's best for it and hope I can win people over to it. And oftentimes I can't, but the only thing that's changed for me over many years is I think I'm more sensitive to the needs that the industry people have, and I understand that they just aren't going to use a lot of what I like, and that they have a boss and they have a business and they have to make money, and you know, but I also am better at understanding maybe where something can go and why it should go there, and it maybe has the best shot at that network or in this space. And so I think that's where some experience, you know, I've seen great things where a great piece of work, it's just in the wrong place and it's not going to succeed there. So that's where you can go, I have some control, I have this idea, I think it's great, develop it. Where does it belong? And if it belongs in only one place, that's difficult. Now, sometimes that's the way it is. This is only going to play on HBO. It's the only place it'll ever live. So if they say, no, you're dead. You're dead. And you're probably exactly right that it'll only play there. But you can take your ideas sometimes and let them sit and wait on them. And maybe over the course of a year or two, go, oh, you know what? If I took that same sensibility and that idea, but I infused it with this, which is exciting to me, now it can play on four or five places might be interested in it. And so pay attention to what people are doing, and you have to deal with it. And you know, people who write have this fantasy that they go in a corner and write their thing like a novelist, and then they submit it, and somebody goes, oh, this is genius. Just make it like this. Don't touch it. It just doesn't happen. I mean, really, outside of Woody Allen, who has to go to Europe, you know, to get money.
Well, that's because he married his daughter, probably, then.
Right. I don't know.
Well, yeah, it's such a rare exception. Like, someone like James L. Brooks, I don't know if this is true, but I like to believe it's true, that when he decided to executive produce The Simpsons when they were starting, he said, I'll do it, one condition, no notes ever. And but he was in a position to have
but
the
Fox
clout.
Was
he was
nothing.
An Oscar-winning
Fox
director.
Fox was nothing. Him doing a show on Fox was like...
Oh, that's
you know,
point.
I mean, it was this start, this junk network, stupid idiots trying to start a fourth network.
That's a good point.
You know, nobody thought it was legitimate. It was ridiculous.
Yeah.
So here comes this huge name at the height of his career, by the way.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
And of course he can say that, you know?
That's very rare, obviously, you know, for someone to be able to do that. But I think... I think, you know, Bob's been through this a lot more than I have. Like, I think in my own experience, I was, when I started at Late Night, for example, it was kind of left alone because we were sort of like kids up in the attic where it was doing well enough where they just weren't really going to mess with us and you could kind of do whatever you want. But the Tonight Show, it was suddenly you're on this other stage where suddenly you're expected to deliver real numbers and stuff. And it was a completely different ball game, you know. So that was very eye-opening to me because I'd been very spoiled by being.
What did
you? Know,
you well, I'm curious. What happened? Did the network send people around to watch the show like there live more, or did you get notes written?
You know,
from the
got,
network, did you guys hear directives from them?
You know, if we got notes, I think they may have been coming in more towards Conan. Like, I don't remember hearing any direct notes. I think, though, some of it ended up being self-imposed censorship where you're like, well, the Tonight Show had a lot of baggage with it and a lot of institutional baggage. Nothing against the franchise and the history and everything, but it felt like it was just too big for me, for my taste. It felt too big, studio was too big, the show felt too big. I don't miss it at all. But I miss our budget. We had a good, a good budget. But it was, it just felt like there was just, oh, can we do this on the Tonight Show? You know, you start asking yourself questions that you never asked yourself before. Like at late night, I never remember ever asking myself, can we do this? You just do it. If you think it's funny, you just, let's just try it. And a lot of stuff fails, but you just, it was very experimental. And at the Tonight Show, it felt, even if someone wasn't coming in and telling you what you could and couldn't do, you start almost imposing some of that on yourself. So some of it was just our own fault, you know. But
yeah, and I think I've pitched a million things from cartoons to shows I've made and filmed or just a script or whatever. It never goes. And the meeting always starts because someone saw my stand-up and liked my voice, and then you get in the room and you realize you're both trying to put square pegs and round holes. They're like, oh, I just thought because you're creative, you might have an idea about teenagers who like sharks. And I'm like, nope, I just have what I do. And, you know, these are my five ideas. And it's like, maybe it's timing, maybe it's whatever, but in terms of like how you cope, at least I can go do stand up and, you know, do that kind of thing. And so I feel like if people don't do stand up and they write and they're like, because I feel like it must feel the same way for actors who just audition. Whenever I go on auditions and I go, none of us are getting this role, but I can go do stand up tonight. Would these people have to just go home and wait for the next audition? It seems so sad. So it's like, I don't know. I mean, I probably sound like someone's great aunt or something, but like, if I was just a writer, like maybe I would put up a show called like My Failed Sitcom I pitched this week and like get a bunch of friends to act it out at UCB. Or, I don't know, like something. Just do something.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Something live where that, you know what will happen? You'll do that and then people will think it's amazing because they had to see it, you know, or something like that. I just feel like I would just keep doing stuff on the side because that will end up being the stuff anyway. And I have a couple scripts now that I'm like, I know if I ever got famous, maybe people would just let me do it. Maybe they wouldn't. And you know what? Then they would let me do it and then they would kill it or whatever. But... And especially with the cope thing of, like, just being a writer on a show that, you know, I would just have the mentality that it's going to get canceled every second. Like, not in a neurotic way, but just, like, I'm not buying a Lexus right now just because I have this job. Or I'm just going to keep, you know, people at the sitcom I was working on were running out and pitching their ideas to other things. And just keep, never, just keep going. But, and it's funny, like, if you ever have, like, a general meeting, I've learned to ask people what they're looking for, but, like, try to get past their, like, we're looking for 18 to 34. No, like, what? Like, I had a meeting with people at MTV. It was the most eye-opening, wonderful conversation. And I was like, not right for me. My mind doesn't think that way. But she explained what the 25-year-olds who watch the network are like and what they need. Mm-hmm. And it was such a psychological breakdown of it that I was like, holy shit. Like, I was wasting my time trying to jam a couple ideas down their throats. And they're wasting my time with any meeting that wasn't as insightful as the one I had with this woman. I'd met with other people there about other things, and they'd just be like, edgy women, 18 to 34. And I was like, I don't know what that is. But this woman actually explained this very insightful thing. And so, which I guess I'll share if anyone
Please.
Cares. But she was just saying that this generation of particular kids who watch MTV are from a generation where their parents want to be their friends. And it's not like they don't relate to something if they saw Wonder Years. Like, that doesn't make sense in these parents that are like, do this, do that. So it, because they have these parents that are their friends, they literally don't know how to do anything. Like laundry they really just like, they love to watch shows about stuff they don't know a lot about, like love, you know, like the, you know, like a lot of people watching the Sex and the City reruns are like 18 because they're just like, wow, like that's love, you know, that's love or whatever. So like they want to like be taught stuff but not talked down to. So it's like that. I was like, I never would have thought that. I would have just thought these fucking stupid idiots are just, you know. So it's like, but I don't have anything for them. So I don't know. It's kind of like getting to know the networks too.
It's hard to know what they're thinking and what they want, you know. And you got to be careful because they change what they want
too.
But you got to work from your honest place of what you want to do, right? But when you start to develop an idea, then you can start to ask yourself, where might this belong? And you can develop towards that if it's organic. But the other thing is, I think, you know, you have to think about the bosses of the bosses. Like, you meet the people whose job is to go out there and see young talent and meet them and get to know what's happening. But they have a boss, and they have a boss, and they have a boss. I mean, Jeff Zucker has a boss.
Mm-hmm.
You guys, Jeff Bukas has a boss. And these guys are corporate people. They didn't get into it because they're free-ranging, you know, people with crazy new ideas. They like to be inside a corporation and have a boss and have people below them and work in that, you know, scenario. And so you have to start to think about that, you know. And so the weird disconnect can come where people see us or see our stuff and go, man, I love you. You're so great. You're so funny. I watch you. All my friends watch you. But then at some point that person has to go to their boss who you don't get to meet and tell them the idea. And no matter how much they like you, there might be a point where they go, yeah, but that this doesn't work here. So they, you just wasted a meeting, and they wasted a meeting, but they got to meet you. Somebody whose work they genuinely love, you know? But so you have to think about the real bottom lines, you know? And a lot of times I find, I think it's especially true at Comedy Central. It's weird. Like, I think the people who work there are genuine fans of, like, cool comedy. But look, what works there? I mean, what works there? I mean, the roasts are huge. By the way, I like them. They make me laugh.
It's weird because a lot of different things work there. That and Jon Stewart.
Yeah, Jon Stewart and South Park work, but those things kind of like, it doesn't feel like they belong with the rest of the
network.
Yeah. They really stick out as their own little time slots, and then they don't fit with anything around them. Anyhow.
It's almost like you're pitching to Jack McBrayer's character, and you're like, this is great, and then you forget. He's going to take it up to Alec Baldwin. You're not getting your thing made.
Yeah. Well, I got to say, though, I'm very encouraged these days by maybe the fact that there's these cable channels like AMC. Like, I think a show like Breaking Bad, just the fact that it's a brilliant show like that is on the air, even though I can't really imagine it on a regular network, you know, or the fact that David Chase originally was developing The Sopranos for Fox. Like, sometimes things should end up where they end up, you know, like they're just, but I'm encouraged by the fact that shows like that are on the air these days and that there's voices like that.
There are more niches being created, more people taking chances.
FX, things like Justified. And
work than there have ever been.
Absolutely. More questions. Yes, right over here. Breaking in stories.
I don't know. What does that mean? Like first job or how you broke in? Or
first real job.
In the profession that you are in now.
Sure. Anything I ever got was from stand-up. Like my first real TV stuff. It's just all... I just went and did stand-up, did open mics, did everything, worked my way up through the stand-up circuit, and it would just be like, hey, Comedy Central's putting you on this quick little ditty of a show. So for me, it was like... I could say, I've been on all these TV things, or I've written a couple things for this and that, but it never was sustaining. Like, it wasn't, I always was just freelance for 13 years, so it was like, I never thought of the breaking in, really, you know what I mean?
Do you remember the first time somebody from television came to you, or did you go to television the first time?
Yeah, I think it was this show on Comedy Central called Premium Blend, and... I was living in New York. No, I'm sorry. It was Boston. I started comedy in Boston, and Brendan Small got that show Home Movies, that Cartoon Network show. And it was literally like, well, it's the five of us comics that perform together every week, and the production company was like, you're all on it. You know, like he got to write characters. So that, I mean, to me, it was just like, oh, my friend wrote me a part.
Right.
And that's honestly how it's been from there on out. And every once in a while, because of stand-up, there'll be an executive in the audience, you know, hey, you can do this, but... For me, it's just always been, except for getting a job writing on Chelsea and Perfect Couples, which was just, I wrote a packet and submitted it. But everything is through friends and who you come up with.
In that first case, it was right place, right time, and being ready for the opportunity.
Yeah.
Yeah. Brian?
For me, I kind of fell into writing through doing improv. I did it in Chicago and in Madison, Wisconsin when I was going to school. At first, just for fun and on weekends for no money. And then I worked at Second City for a few years where Bob had worked too. And... then my break was actually from a literal break. There was a guy at Conan who broke his leg really badly, Tommy Blacha, and he was actually had to stay home, and they wanted to bring someone out for one cycle to fill in, and some of the guys recommended me, and I came out, and then they were nice enough to keep me on even after Tommy came back. And I always think of someone asked Amy Poehler in an in an interview, you know, what advice she'd give for improvisers wanting to break into comedy. And I remember she said, don't expect to make any money or own anything for 10 years. If you stick with it and you know what you're doing, one of your friends will give you a job. And I thought, that's actually true for so many people I know. It's like someone you know gets in, mm-hmm. and they liked your work back when they worked with you back in some other city, and they recommend you for something. And I've done the same thing for people. It's happened to me. And I think for the majority of the people I know, it ends up being their relationships with other comedians. Mm-hmm. And, you know, you can make a lot of stuff happen on your own, too, of course. But I think, you know, it's working with people and finding people that are on your wavelength, and they end up thinking of you for stuff. And that, I think, is...
I think that's so true. I went to Emerson College, and it wasn't a good school when I was there. And a lot of people go there now, and they come out here, and they're like, hey, I'm going to network with you. And I'm like, I'm not in your generation. Go look to the person to the left and to the right of you. They'll be the next, you know, Patton or Zach or whatever. You know, mm-hmm. my generation is different, and my friends helped me because we were all naturally friends. Well, I didn't go network to Paul, you know what I mean? So it's like, you just be... somebody will do something. Maybe it'll be you, but... yeah, exactly. I think that friends thing is so true, but people, I think, get impatient.
Absolutely. Yeah. Robert Smigel and I were roommates in Chicago. He was doing a show... He wrote a theater show, a sketch show, that was a hit. It was crazy.
All You Can Eat, right?
Yeah, All You Can Eat. It ran for like a year and a half. Yeah. These guys, like seven actors, and they made, you know, a couple $100 a week, maybe more, each of them. Sold out houses. Like, I think they did, I want to say three shows a week. Maybe it was four. And that was what they did. It was mm-hmm. so great. And so Smigel came to see me in something. Somebody... Todd, I can't remember his last name, told him, you got to see Bob. And he saw me, and he really liked me, and we talked, and he was doing the show, and we got to know each other. And then Dave Reynolds, who works at Pixar now, was in the cast of this show that Robert had written. And Dave got auditioned for Franken and Davis's movie, Just Another Saturday Night, and he got the lead in that movie. So he was going to be missing from the show in Chicago for 3 months. So Robert put me in then, and Robert and I had been writing a show to do after All You Can Eat. We started writing a new sketch show. And we were roommates then, and we became roommates too. And I did the All You Can Eat show while Dave was acting in Just Another Saturday Night. And then Robert, Franken and Davis, who were making Just Another Saturday Night, Dave Reynolds said, you got to come see the sketch show I'm in when you're in Chicago. So they came and saw the sketch show and thought it was great. And, you know, Robert wrote most of it, probably 80 to 90%. And then Franken and Davis were executive producers of SNL the next year. That was the only year they were executive producers. And they hired Robert as a writer. And so then Smigel was there, and he was a very effective writer in that year. It was a kind of a rough year for SNL. Anthony Michael Hall and Robert Downey Jr. were in the cast. It was rough. And but Robert wrote really funny shit. You know, Lorne could see how great he was. And Robert even wrote that last scene, which was the show is burning down and who's going to be saved, right? And so the next year, Robert came back. Well, very few other people came back, including Franken and Davis, who are no longer executive producers. And over the course of the year that he had been there, I'd been, you know, you want somebody to write with, and he didn't know anyone there. So he'd call me, and we'd write for 3 hours on the phone. And I'd write. I was still doing my shit and writing it and send it to him, send him sketches, and he'd pass it around the writer's room. And so then the next year I continued to do that, continued to write with him. And I think I got hired, it was his third year there, the following year, I think. Maybe it was that year or maybe it was the next year that I mean, everybody had read my stuff, or the writing staff had read my stuff. A few of the people. And so there were a couple guys there who said, yeah, his stuff's good. You should hire this guy. And I'd visited twice or three times, and so I'd met everyone. But I wasn't waiting for a job at Saturday Night Live. I didn't think it would ever happen. I don't want to say I didn't care, because it's a huge break, right? But I kind of wasn't thinking about it. I was just doing my own shit. And I could see how that place worked, and I could already tell it was going to be rough for me. You know, so I wasn't, like, chasing it that hard. But anyhow, it was through Robert and through the recommendation by him that I got to work there. And then I would say, as an actor, my break came when Ben let me be in the cast on the Ben Stiller show. And Ben and I shared an office at SNL for the time that he was there. Wasn't too long. I think he was there 2 or 3 months. So we got to know each other there and liked each other. I mean, he's a really funny guy and a really great guy. So then when he had his own show, he hired me. And I got to perform. So those are kind of the breaks. I would say Breaking Bad is kind of a big break for me too, because it's such a different kind of performance. And to be given that opportunity and that trust by Vince Gilligan, who writes that show, is a huge thing. So you can get a couple big breaks. Sure. You hang in there.
Right here in second row. The question is about, the web's influence on the direction of comedy going forward from here.
Well, I think it's incredibly democratic, and I think it gives so many people an opportunity that they wouldn't have had like 10 or 15 years ago, which is, and several people, like I think Andy Samberg and the Human Giant guys and stuff all came out of just doing these web videos. And I think that it's an incredible opportunity for people to get noticed. And if you do something really funny and put it on, like Funny or Die or something, you can get a lot of attention in ways that I don't think would have been possible. I mean, I'm saying very obvious things, but I have a
command of the obvious.
But I think it's an incredibly democratic opportunity for young people today, I think. I think some of it would be considered alternative and maybe not everybody's cup of tea. Some of it's got more broad appeal, but I think all it really takes is for one person to appreciate what you're doing if they're in a position to put you. Like, I always think of Bill Cott, a friend of mine who auditioned for SNL, and he said, he came out of the room and he was just flushed red and he's like, oh, I just bombed. Nobody laughed at it. Anything I did. But Robert had been watching him on The Closed Circuit and thought he was hilarious and hired him for the Dana Carvey show. So it just takes like one person to think what you're doing is, you might think it's
the
not
right
everybody's cup of tea.
Jen, do you want to add anything to that as someone who's been singled out for use of social media and stuff?
I'm going to use the washroom.
Yeah.
Pardon me.
Okay.
I think it's an alternative in the sense that it's an alternative to a stage or a television set, in the way that I think alternative comedy sometimes was defined as like we're doing things in a space that is an alternative to a comedy room. But I don't think of myself as a web person really, but I guess I am because I use Twitter a lot. But I don't know if I'm making any new fans from that, but I don't know. I really don't know. Like, I don't know what's happening. Like, I did Drunk History, and it won Sundance, but no one knows who I am from that at all. I never once got anything from that. Never once. Not like nothing happened. I don't mean it like that, but I mean, I don't have people at my shows from that or anything like that. I think people like that are just out there in America that don't know what comedy is really. Most people think I'm a historian that got drunk, and the other narrators too. They think that's what the series is historians getting drunk. So it's like sometimes the web can help and sometimes it's just there. You know, for me, I don't know.
That's a great series.
Yeah. That actually could be very funny. But so I don't know. I don't think of myself as a web person. Like, it wouldn't dawn on me to know how to make a funny video.
This is probably a good time to mention that Rolling Stone just Talked you up as somebody who was very key to be following on podcasts and Twitter and so on.
Oh, that's true.
People.
Yeah. Well, you make it sound so much more than it. But yeah, like I do a lot of podcasts. Actually, yeah, I guess that is the internet, isn't it? Podcasts.
Sure.
I don't think of it as that, but I would say podcasts have helped my audience a lot. I did a show in San Francisco and it was only 100 people, but I didn't think 4 years ago I'd get 100 people to come see me, and it had nothing to do with any TV. It was all podcast fans from different shows, and the Pod F. Tomcast, which I do, Pod F. Tomkin show, is it was mentioned in Rolling Stone, and so yeah, I guess you're right. It, but I feel like stuff like that, like podcasts and internet, I feel like you're going to attract more like-minded people, if that makes any sense. Like, I get a lot of fans from Chelsea lately, but then they don't necessarily, they're very surprised when they find out who I really am. You know, like when they follow me on Twitter and they're like, you're a liberal? Like, they don't know what is happening, you know? But with podcasts and internet fans, like, they know exactly who you are. So you might get a smaller amount, but a more dedicated amount.
But also, either way, you're attracting more people.
Yeah, oh, yeah,
period.
Definitely.
So
yeah,
people are finding you.
Yeah, I mean, I know Mark Maron's been saying, I think his WTF podcast is very addictive, just like Paul's is. And he says, you know, like there's a lot of people coming out to see his shows that have been introduced to him through the podcast. I think that's only going to grow. You know, I think that's a whole world that's going to just continue to grow. And
are you guys saying that the internet is killing comedy?
Of course.
I agree.
No more time podcasts.
More questions, yes. Approaching writing for others.
You know, I probably don't write that well for other people like that, or I would have done it. You know, I mean, I've certainly wrote things for Farley and for Sandler and with Adam and for Ben and stuff, but it's never really what I've always just written what I was interested in, and then there were things that were good for them. So I'm not one of those guys, so I'm probably not a good judge of how you do that or anything. Or I would have done it, you know, because I had certainly plenty of opportunity to write, you know, for I have had quite a few people who are massive stars and who I thought would be massive, but I just lose interest in maybe their voice is not as interesting to me as my own, you know. It sounds funny, but I don't know. There's people who, I know Tim Hurley, he's written a bunch of movies for Adam, and, you know, he just gets that voice and enjoys it, and it's probably representative of him. And even though I wrote some good stuff for certainly Chris Farley, I think I would have liked to have written a movie for Chris, but it's just not who I am to just go write for other people. And, I mean, Sandler I love, too, and he makes me laugh, and I would never want to be one of those guys in the stable writing movies for them, you know? So it's probably made me poorer financially, but it's just who I am. It's not even a choice. I don't even know. I mean, you write for Conan, and or does Conan do your stuff? You know what I mean?
Well, it's weird. Like, I think it used to be more the case where we would have these insane characters that would be revolving around Conan, and he was a little bit more of the straight man. Like, he would be like, Stack, you're turning me into Mr. Mooney again. like, because it would just be him going, this is insane. And what are you doing here? And it was always just, and at late night, that tended to be, and that's actually naturally what I'm inclined to write, is usually something that's insane, that's happening, that's interrupting the show, or revolving around him. And I think over time, and I completely understand why this happened, I think he got a little less interested in that and wanted to drive things a little more. And I've tried to adapt to that, but I think what I'm naturally more inclined to do and better at is writing stuff that's where there's a brain in a jar that says it's going to destroy him or something. Where and he is less inclined to want to do that these days. But I understand that. But so it's been a challenge for me to try to write more things that he can actually drive himself, you know, and be the main force of. Because there were countless things I wrote in New York where he was just kind of the straight man, you know. And so, yeah, it's been a challenge to write stuff where he can be the driving force of the sketch, you know.
Jen, working with Chelsea?
Yeah, I think, I don't know if this happens at Conan, but like there's this group mind that happens and you all start sounding like each other and you all talk the same way. Like we all kind of behave like each other and it's hard to tell what happens. So sometimes it's good to break that. But I think there's a difference between point of view and voice. Like if I'm pitching something, well, I don't do much pop culture in my act anyway, but let's say I did. If I'm pitching something to Chelsea, there's no time to be like, well, that's for me and that's for her. And that, like you're just trying to say the funniest thing and I'll say something that I know she's not thinking of. Her mind won't work that way. Like, I'll go here where she'd go there, and she'll be like, oh, that's so fucking funny. And then she'll know, okay, and I'll filter it through my brain, and it'll come out like this. So that's just, I gave her a different point of view on that one. But if it's my voice that comes out by accident, then I think any host who knows their own voice would be like, no, that's more you. You say that, you know, if I was going to be on the show that day or if not. So I think it's really, you're not risking anything. Just say the funniest thing. And what they want is your point of view, because they want, you know, if 10 different people have different points of view but they all can write for this one voice, then that voice seems, you know, has way more facets. But yeah, I don't think you ever really risk giving up your own stuff unless you were like, I don't know, a political comic writing for Jon Stewart and you were just like him and you would deliver the jokes in the same way. I guess you would probably want to not work there or something. But but no, I think it's pretty easy actually. I enjoy kind of not thinking about me.
Time for a couple more, just a couple more. Yeah, right here. Your particular comedic instinct, where it started and where it is now and how it evolved.
I could be wrong, but I think that a lot of the things that I found funny as a kid are still things that I find funny. I remember loving Woody Allen even as a kid. I remember loving, you know, Monty Python as a kid. The Three Stooges, you know, a lot of the stuff that continues to make me laugh. I don't think my own sensibility has changed much since I was a kid.
Yeah. Stuff that made an impression upon you when you were really young just stays with you.
Yeah, I remember loving the old Bob Newhart show and yeah. Mary Tyler Moore and, you know, the Marx Brothers, you know, a lot of the stuff that I continue to love. I can't think of anything I ever lost interest in that I really loved as a kid. Mm-hmm.
It's funny. I grew up, I liked really absurd stuff. And like, not really absurd, but I liked like the Weird Al and the Dr. Demento stuff and this kind of nerd shit and all that. And I don't like any of that now. Like the minute I got on stage to open my mouth, a totally different thing happened. And I was like, oh, I guess I like, you know, I like more based in reality kind of self whatever stuff. And now I don't like that stuff anymore. So it's weird. I don't know. I wouldn't say that's the trajectory of it. But I think when I was little, I liked really weird things. And then as I got older, I'm becoming more and more, it's terrible, closed off to like fantastical things. I'm like, oh, I don't think it's too much thinking. So I'm trying to evolve more in that way, let more in and not be like, I like this stuff and that's it. But I don't think about it consciously, so maybe I will after that question.
Yeah, I have a hard time answering that question because I think I like so many different kinds of voices in comedy. And I've never found it easy to pin myself down as far as what my voice is, you know. I think it's one thing that's made it hard for me to do stand up or be very successful at stand up, which I've done a lot of, hours and hours, and enjoyed it. But you know, I'll tell jokes one night, and then one night I'll just talk about my family or something, and then another night I'll sort of present conceptual bits. You know, it's just like there's no. It's not a very clearly defined voice that I have. But I think when you... The only thing that question makes me think of is... I think I like making fun of people. I think that my dad was really sarcastic, and I think about True Grit last night, and even though I didn't like my dad very much... he made me laugh really hard once when I was like 9 years old and we were going to this hockey game and we were lost near the stadium and he pulled over and there was an old dude there and he goes, hey, let me ask you, hey, buddy, where's the stadium around here? You know, we're going to the Cougar game. It was the World Hockey League and it didn't last too long. And this guy mumbled something, you know, like you couldn't make out what he was saying. And then my dad goes, Thanks. That's going to help us a lot. And I laughed so hard. It made me laugh so hard. And I thought, what did he do? He thanked that guy. Why did he thank him? That guy didn't help at all. But I understood that it was funny, and it made me so happy, and it was so awesome. And watching True Grit last night and looking over at my son, huh? These guys, these morons, look at these idiots.
What was his review of the movie, by the way? What was his review of the movie, by the way?
My son?
Yeah.
Oh, he loves it. He loves it, but I can't tell. I know that they love it. They really, both my son and daughter can tell it's really great filmmaking, right? And it's also not just, it's not pandering at all like so many movies you share with kids. And that's not always a bad thing, you know? Kind of holding your hand throughout. This doesn't hold your hand, you know, and I think they get it. They're old enough to understand that's cool, and really they respect it. But I can't tell if when I was looking at him last night, he was understanding what was funny or just really enjoying that I kept looking at him like, oh, yeah, I know, you know, because it just everything in that movie kind of makes me laugh.
Were they laughing? They weren't laughing.
Oh, we did laugh at a lot of things in it. There's just a lot of humor in that movie. There is.
What were they laughing before you were laughing?
No, I wouldn't say they were laughing. I'm not sure they were. But I think that doesn't mean they don't see it or get it. Because somebody can cue you into something. You know what I mean? And then you start to, it can be funny. These serious people, and everything is deadly serious in the movie, can have a funny dimension to it. And they get that from you. Oh, okay. And then maybe they start to see it. So I think he sees it, you know. And then I would say one other thing, but I don't know if this is my voice, but it's something I've thought about a lot. I told my daughter, I said, you know, honey, comedy is about honesty. Now, look, we talk like this at my house. My wife is a manager. And we talk about comedy. I wonder what my kids are going to be like, but we talk about. I say things like that's funny, but it's really just clever. It's not really funny. Real funny is not exactly like clever. And cleverness can be great, but it's not as valuable as funny. I mean, I'll say that to my kids.
Yeah.
And I want them to think about that. You know, but I said, this is the great wisdom all about comedy. And I was like, you know, honey, comedy is about honesty. That's really what it's about. And I think that's what it's about. I really think that for me, that's what it's about. And I really think on some level, really almost any comedy, to me, that's its value, you know. And of course, there's really, really soft stuff that is sort of trying not to be honest, but maybe just touching on some honesty in it. But so the question was your voice. I don't know if that influences anything, though. It's just what I think is at the core of it. It's like a way comedy's bits and things that you see are ways for people to be honest about how they are and how they're hypocrites and how, you know, they're full of shit and laugh about, you know, do something with that energy that everyone kind of feels, you know.
And I don't know if this goes with your question, but kind of what you said, I try to work from a place of honesty with my comedy. That's why it's hard for me to say like what I'm working towards, because I just want to be honest about everything I'm experiencing, and I don't know what I'm going to experience next. I never would have thought I got married. I never would have thought anything I did in my life. So I just, my comedy is an honest reaction to what I'm going through. And I feel like the minute you're on to yourself, like, oh, the Jen Kirkman way to do is to be like, oh, crazy, blah, 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 then you're not going to be funny. And so it's just kind of like keep being yourself as much as you can, like, on stage, instead of going like, how, what's my brand, like the way that people talk at you, these horrible people that make you think about things like that. So
let me wrap up by asking a really quick question, which is, who are each of you looking at now in comedy and really enjoying and anxious to watch develop?
I've been working with the Birthday Boys. It's a group here in town. I think they're really funny, and they kind of have similar to Tim and Eric, when I first saw them, I thought, you know, they've defined a certain sensibility, and that's kind of hard to do. And that's, being funny is great, and it will get you work, and you can work, and that's, you should. But then defining a voice is like a next step. If you can do it, if it happens, I don't think you can do it artificially, really. But anyhow, mm-hmm. those guys, and they really have made me very happy. The stuff they've brought in, we've laughed, and they just continually bring in funny stuff. So I've been working with them, and you know, Zach Galifianakis is always. Since I first saw him at Largo and stuff, he just kills me. So he's always funny. And Gervais is kind of always funny to me. Yeah, that's about it.
Brian, anybody you're looking at?
You know, I wish I was more in touch with a lot of the stuff that was going on today, but I occasionally do go by UCB and do some improv shows there, and I'm always impressed by a lot of the younger people coming up. But, yeah, like, it sometimes when I see someone like Zach, you know, who I was a big fan of years ago, even when he would do little bits on Late Night or something, it feels like, oh, there is some justice, you know, where sometimes things like that happen for people like that. And or Carell or people I used to idolize back in Chicago years ago, you know, and walk up to in 7-Eleven parking lots like a geek and just, you know,
you're really awesome. You're really, really keep doing what you're doing.
And so it's just nice, you know, sometimes when it does happen for the right people. But, yeah, I wish I was more in touch with what was going on.
There's one other person I got to mention, Jenna Friedman, and she's a stand-up. And she did this piece that's like a takeoff on the New York Times wedding announcement videos. So funny.
Nice.
You'd love it. It's so great. She's really funny.
Her name sounds familiar.
Kimmy Gatewood do some bits for us recently, and she's really a wonderful performer. And she seems like one of those people that's just on I mean, I know a lot of people love what she's doing already, but I think
who's that?
She's going to be one of those people that people know who she
Brian,
is.
Who's that?
Kimmy Gatewood, you know? She's in the Apple Sisters, which is this trio of people, and she's been very close to getting things like SNL and The Office and things like that. I think people are going to know who she is one of these days because she's really great.
I'm just keeping my eye out on any models who might do comedy. I think that's kind of the next wave. And then, but there, I mean, I don't see a lot of like new people. I feel bad, but I mean, like anything that like Tom Sharpling's doing on The Best Show in WFMU John Mercer, and I really like the whole music and comedy thing coming together again. I like to see more of that. And I like Reggie Watts a lot, and I like, I like a lot of stuff, and Zach too. I mean, I'd love Zach to be more known for his stand up, you know, than the movie. I mean, whatever he wants, I want. But I would, you know, stuff like that. It just makes me happy. And I know he's doing a show with fucking crazy ass Brody Stevens, and you know, my friend Joe's working on this. So it'd be nice to just see these weirder things kind of pop up from people's celebrity gardens.
Yeah, John Worcester, he's one of my favorite people on earth. And if you want to hear on iTunes, Best Show Gems. The phone calls where he would call in to talk to Tom Sharpling as these various characters. It's just, and he's also one of the greatest drummers on earth, which is not fair because you shouldn't be funny and be a great musician.
It makes all drummers think they're funny.
Yeah.
Dave Grohl.
Yeah, he's an amazing musician and one of the funniest people I've ever met. So.
Yeah. And there's a lot of gay acts. It really sucks. I went to see the show at Akbar last week, and this gay guy was so fucking funny. It was just like, he was funny because he's funny, but he was funny because he had this great gay affectation that he was on to. And I'm like, I never see shit like that on TV. Like, there's just no fucking, like, overtly gay men on TV, really, as stand-ups. And they're so fucking funny. I don't mean they are gay people, but I just mean a lot of gay acts I know are just so goddamn funny. They've been working their ass off for 10, 20 years, and their stand-up is fucking tight. You never see them on Comedy Central. You never see them on anything. So I wish that would happen more, but... I feel like lesbians are more accepted in comedy than gay men, which is not bad or good, but there's some real, like, flaming dudes who are super funny, and I wish I wish everyone liked them.
Yeah. All right. Jen Kirkman, Brian Stack, Bob Odenkirk, thank you all so much for being here.
Oh, thank you.
This was great. I just wish we had more time. I also want to thank 826 LA. Want to thank Barry and Ed for making sure all the wires connect and things sound good. And I want to thank Nerdist here at Meltdown for helping us put this together. Thank you all very much for being here.
Thank you.
Now leaving Nerdist.com.